they began to burrow in the ground. They dug up the tulip bulbs, first of all, seeming particularly fond of them. Then they attacked the less palatable bulbs and roots. They ran along the branches of the trees, apparently eating any insects they could find or any remains of seeds or fruit. They even at last began to gnaw the bark of young trees, like rabbits. Ish parked the car as close to the house as he could now and made a dash for it, wearing high boots. But actually, the rats never made any attempt at an attack. Ish kept Princess in the house mostly, although the rats had offered her no violence either. Still driving about to investigate, Ish became more and more accustomed to the soft squash beneath his tires. He began to feel as if he were plastering the streets with a continuous line of crushed rats. In the angle of two walls, as he drove slowly by, a small white object caught his attention. Stopping the car and looking carefully, he saw that it was the skull of some small dog. The long teeth, still shining white, indicated that it had probably been a terrier. Apparently, the rats had cornered the dog in the angle of the walls, or else the dog, fighting for its life, had retreated there. Whether the rats had dared attack a strong and healthy dog, Ish could not know. Perhaps it had suffered an accident or had been chewed up in a fight with another dog. Perhaps it was old or sick. But apparently, for once, the swarm of rats had been too much even for the ratter. Ish saw only a few of the larger bones. The rest had apparently been either gnawed to pieces or dragged away. In the vicinity, he saw also the skulls of several rats, indicating that the terrier had gone down fighting. He tried to imagine the scene, the swarming gray bodies clambering all over the struggling dog, the dog unable to attack those which hung to its back. Others must have slashed at the hamstrings like wolves attacking an old bison bull. Though the dog might kill a dozen or 50, in the end, the mad, hunger-frenzied rodents must have gnawed through the skin and tendons until the dog collapsed. Ish drove away from the spot feeling definitely sober, and deciding that they must keep an even more careful watch on Princess. He remembered, hopefully, that the ants had vanished almost overnight, and he kept expecting that something like that also might happen to the rats. But there was no indication of it.
"Are the rats going to take over the world?" Em asked. "Now that men are gone, are the rats going to be next?"
"Of course I don't know for sure," said Ish. "But I hardly think so. They've got a head start because they know how to use the food supplies in the city and because they breed fast. But once they get away from the city, they'll have to forage on their own. And the foxes and snakes and owls are going to build up too because man is gone, and because they'll have lots of rats to feed on."
"I never thought of that," she said. "You mean rats are kind of domestic animals because people supply them food and kill off their enemies.
More like parasites on man, I suppose, really." And then, just to be saying something to keep her interest, he ran on. "And speaking of parasites, of course, rats have them too, just like the ants. When anything gets too numerous, it's likely to get hit by some plague. I mean," something had suddenly exploded in his mind at the word. He coughed to cover up his hesitation, and then went on, without making a point of it. "Yes, some plague is likely to hit them." Em, to his relief, did not seem to have noticed.
"All we can do then," she said, "I guess, is to sit around and cheer for the rat's parasites."
Ish did not tell her what had disturbed him. It was the realization that not just plague in the general sense, but bubonic plague was a common epidemic among rats. It was spread, he knew, by fleas, and those infected fleas readily hopped from dead rats to living people. The thought of being among the few people left in an area inhabited by millions of rats being killed off by bubonic plague was a horrible situation to contemplate. He began to deluge the house with DDT and spray it upon his clothing and M's. Naturally, then she became suspicious, and he had to tell her. She was not disturbed. Her natural courage rose superior to even the thought of plague, and perhaps there was a vein of fatalism in her too. The simplest and safest thing would have been to hurry out of the city and get to some place, the desert perhaps, where few rats could live. But each of them had already decided independently that life was not to be lived on the basis of fear. Her courage, indeed, was stronger than his, and the horror of the rats pressed in more closely upon him. Occasionally, he even felt panic, and was ready to force her into the car for flight. But always, in such times, her courage seemed to flow out from her and sustain him. As the days passed, he watched individual rats carefully to see if they seemed sickly. On the contrary, they seemed more active than ever. Then M called to him one morning from the window. "Look, they're fighting." He went to look, quickly, but without too much interest. Probably, he thought, it was merely whatever kind of sex play rats indulged in. But it was not. He saw a large rat definitely attacking a smaller one. The small one fought back and dodged desperately and seemed just about to make its escape through a hole which might be too small for the larger one. Then suddenly, a third and still larger rat appeared and sprang also upon the small one. The little pool of blood spread out from the torn throat, and then the largest rat dragged the body away, the one who had made the original attack, scurrying close after. In high boots, well gloved, carrying a stout stick in his hand, Ish made an expedition to the nearest business center and foraged for some more food. Curiously to him, he found very few rats in the stores, and when he investigated, he found that everything which a rat could get and eat had been completely wiped out. The stores were a great disgusting litter of torn papers and chewed cartons and rat droppings. They had even chewed the labels on the cans and bottles, so that sometimes it was difficult even to tell what was contained in them. Certainly, as yet, starvation and not disease was closing in upon the hordes. He took the news back to M. Next morning, they let Princess out for her daily run. They had been allowing her out only once a day as a matter of precaution. After a few minutes, they heard her wild howling, and she came tearing back to the door with rats skirmishing all around her, and two or three actually clinging to her back. Opening the door, they let her in, and necessarily admitted three or four rats along with her. Princess retired under the davenport in a flurry of howling. Deserted by the cause of the disaster, Ish and M spent a lively quarter hour routing out the rats and killing them. They hunted the house most carefully, aided by a now partially recovered princess, to find whether any rat was still lurking in a closet or behind the books of the bookcase. But they decided that they had killed them all. They kept Princess shut up after that, out of necessary precaution, and they also muzzled her for fear of hydrophobia. By now, they were quite sure that the rats were preying one upon another. Sometimes they saw a large rat pursuing a smaller rat, and sometimes it seemed as if several banded together in a pack to attack a single one. They seemed less numerous now, but that might be because they were keeping out of sight under the new conditions. To Ish, the whole affair, in spite of a certain horror that he still held of it, came to be a most interesting study in ecology, almost a laboratory problem. The rats had first lived upon the stores of food which men had laid up for them, and these had gradually been transformed into a great reservoir of rat flesh. Then, when the cereals and dried fruit and packaged beans were depleted, there was left, for certain individual rats at least, this other supply of food. Under such circumstances, it seemed a question whether any single rat would die of starvation, even though the rats as a species might be dying of starvation. The old and sickly and weak and immature will go first, he said, and then those that are not quite so old or sickly or weak or immature, and so on.
And eventually, said M, who sometimes showed disconcerting logic. Two great strong rats left to fight it out. Like, what was it? The Kilkenny cats.
Ish explained that before such a fate ensued, the rats would have become so scarce that they would again have begun to forage upon other sources of food. When he thought more deeply, he saw that the rats were not actually destroying the species for their own individual preservation. They were really saving the species. If the rats had been sentimental and had decided that they would all starve together without indulging in cannibalism, then indeed there might have been some danger. But rats were realists, and so their racial future seemed secure from this emergency. Day by day, the numbers of rats became fewer. And then, one morning, they seemed to be gone entirely. Ish knew that there still must be many rats in the city, but what had happened was merely what would happen in the decline of any species. Under natural circumstances, the rats kept out of sight, in narrow passageways and holes and brush-filled gullies. Only when their numbers became so great that they could not all find such refuges did they spill over and inhabit the open places where they could be seen. Doubtless, at the end, disease may have helped, but he was never sure of this. One great advantage of the disappearance through cannibalism was that there were no bodies of rats left around. They had gone on to preserve the species into the next generation. Also, he knew, although he did not investigate, that the rats must have done a great deal toward removing the bodies of the human beings who had died in the original disaster. As he collected his thoughts upon the subject, he was surprised that there had been no plague of mice. The ants had come first, and then had come the rats. Between the two, there should have been a rapid increase of mice, because the mice should have had almost as good an opportunity as the rats, and because their breeding rate was even faster. He never learned the answer, but merely had to suppose that some control of which he knew nothing had acted to prevent the rapid increase of mice. Both Ish and M took a little while to recover from the horror with which the rats had filled them. But after a while, they decided that Princess had not contracted hydrophobia. They loosed her, and life became more normal, and they forgot about the constant crawling of the gray bodies. The fables were wrong. Not the lion, but man was the king of beasts. Throughout his reign, the rule was heavy, often harsh. But though the cry rise up, "The king is dead," it shall not go on. Long live the king. As in the old days when some conqueror died, leaving no tall son, and the captains strove together for the scepter, and none proved strong enough, and the realm fell apart, so it shall be again. For neither the ant, nor the rat, nor the dog, nor the ape is wise enough above his fellows. For a little while there will be jostlings, quick rises and sudden falls, then a quiet and a peace such as the earth has not known in 20,000 years. Again her head lay on the crook of his arm, and he looked down into the dark eyes. She spoke. "Well, you'd better get busy at that bookwork now. I guess it's happened." And then suddenly, before he could say anything, he felt her tremble and she was crying. He had not thought this of her, this fear. He felt the sudden weakness of his own terror. What if she collapsed? "Oh, darling," he cried out. "Maybe we can still do something. There are ways. You mustn't try to go through with it." "Oh, it's not that. It's not that," she cried out, still trembling. "I lied. Not what I said, what I didn't say. But it's all the same. You're just a nice boy.
You looked at my hands and said they were nice. You never even noticed the blue in the half moons.
He felt the shock, and he knew that she felt the shock in him. Now everything came together in his mind. Brunette complexion, dark liquid eyes, full lips, white teeth, rich voice, accepting temperament. Then she spoke again, scarcely in more than a whisper.
It didn't matter at first, of course. No man cares then about that. But my mother's people never had much luck in the world. Maybe when things are starting out again, it shouldn't be with them. But mostly, I guess, I think it wasn't right with you.
Then suddenly he heard nothing more, for the whole vast farce of everything broke in upon him, and he laughed, and all he could do was to laugh and laugh more. And then he found that she too had relaxed and was laughing with him and holding him all the closer. Oh, darling, he said, everything is smashed, and New York lies empty from Spite and Diable to the Battery. And there's no government in Washington. The senators and the judges and the governors are all dead and rotten, and the Jew baiters and the Negro baiters along with them. We're just two poor people, picking at the leavings of civilization for our lives, not knowing whether it's to be the ants or the rats or something else will get us. Maybe 1,000 years from now, people can afford the luxury of wondering and worrying about that kind of thing again. But I doubt it. And now there are just the two of us here. Or maybe three now. He kissed her while she was still weeping quietly, and he knew that for once he had seen more clearly and more deeply and been stronger than she. Chapter 8. On the day after she had told him, he drove to the university campus and parked in front of the library. He had never entered it since the great disaster, although he had often gone to the city library for books. The great building stood undisturbed. Its surrounding bushes and trees had not, in the few months, grown appreciably taller. The drain pipes all seemed to be functioning perfectly, and no stain of water showed on the white granite walls. There was only a general impression of dirt and litter and disuse. He did not want to force an entrance by breaking a window, thus giving access to animals and also to the rain. In the end, however, he could find no other way. He tapped gently with his hammer and managed to break only a part of a pane. Reaching through, he unlocked the window and raised it. After all, he told himself, he could bring some boards and patch the window again, so that it would still be rat-proof and weatherproof. He had been in the library hundreds of times before, as a matter of course, during his years at the university. But now, under the changed conditions, he felt a strange new sense of awe. Here rested, in storage, the wisdom by which civilization had been built and could be rebuilt. Now that he knew himself soon to be a father, he had suddenly a new attitude, a feeling for the future. The child should not grow up to be a parasite, scavenging forever. And it would not need to. Everything was here. All the knowledge. He had come to hunt up some books on obstetrics, but after looking into the main reading room and then wandering through two levels of the stacks, he became so excited that he left the building in a frenzy of imagination. He did not need to worry about the obstetrics today. There was plenty of time still for that. He drove home in a kind of trance. Books. Most of the knowledge was in books, and yet he soon saw that they were not all. First of all, there must be people who could read, who knew how to use the books. He must also save other things, seeds, for instance. He must see to it that the more important domestic plants did not vanish from the earth. Suddenly, he felt that all civilization depended not only upon men, but also upon these other things which had marched with him like kinsmen and friends and companions. If Saint Francis had hailed the sun as brother, might not we also say, O brother wheat, O sister barley? He smiled to himself. Yes, one could go on. O grandfather wheel, O cousin compass, O friend binomial theorem. All the discoveries of science and philosophy also might be imagined as standing shoulder to shoulder with man, even though the putting of the matter into words made it all sound a little ridiculous. He hurried, still hot with boyish enthusiasm, to tell it all to M. He found her trying, not at all successfully, to teach Princess to retrieve. M was not as enthusiastic as he had expected. Civilization, she said. Oh, you mean airplanes going higher and higher and faster, that kind of thing. Oh, yes. But art, too, you know. Music, literature, culture.
Yes, mystery stories. And those funny Negro jazz bands that always made my ears hurt.
He was crestfallen, even though he knew she was having a little fun with him. Another thing, though, about civilization, she said, there's this matter of time. We don't really know what month it is. We'll want to be sure when his birthday comes so that we can celebrate it something less than 2 years from now. Perhaps, he felt in his mind, that was the difference. That was the difference between woman and man. She felt only in terms of the immediate, and was more interested in being able to spot her child's birthday than in all the future of civilization. Again, he felt superior to her. One thing I didn't do, though, he said, was to read any of those obstetrics books today. I'm sorry, but there's no hurry, is there?
Oh, no. Maybe not even any use of it at all. Don't you remember that even in the old times, babies were always being born in taxis and hospital lobbies? Once they're started, nobody can stop them.
Later, when he had thought things over, he could not but admit that she had made a suggestion of something important. The more he thought about it, the more fundamental he considered her idea of keeping track of time. After all, time was history, and history was tradition. And tradition was civilization. If you lost the continuity of time, you lost something that might never be recovered. Probably, it had already been lost unless some of the other survivors had been more careful about the matter than he had been. Take the 7-day week, for instance. Even though you were not religious, you had to admit that the 7-day week with its 1 day of rest was a fine old tradition of mankind. It had been going on for at least 5,000 years, clear from Babylonian times, and no one knew how much further. Would he ever be able to figure out again just which day was Sunday? As for getting the proper day of the year, that should not be too difficult. He knew enough about the fundamentals of astronomy to do that, and if he got the time of the solstice correct, he could figure back on last year's calendar and perhaps reestablish the day of the week. This was the time of the year to get busy on the problem. Although he did not know exactly, he could tell from the progress of the weather and from his general knowledge of how much time had elapsed since the catastrophe that it must have come now pretty well toward the middle of December. If the solstice was to be in a week or so, he could easily tell by watching where the sun set. Next day, he found a surveyor's transit, and although he did not know much about the use of it, he set it up on the porch, facing the west. He blackened its lenses with soot so that he could observe the sun without hurting his eyes. His very first observation showed that the sun was going down behind the hills of San Francisco to the south of the Golden Gate. From memory, he knew that this was very near to its most southern point of setting. He left the transit in position and recorded the angle of the sunset. The next evening, it set still a little farther south. And then, as systems do, his system went to pieces. A heavy storm blew in from the ocean, and during a whole week he could not observe where the sun set. Next time he saw it, it had already started north.
Well, anyway, he said, we must be pretty close to it. If we add one day to the time when we last saw the sun, we ought to be very near to the solstice, and then if we add 10 days to that, we would get to New Year's.
Isn't that rather silly? She said.
Why?
Well, I mean, that is, shouldn't the year really start when the sun turns north again? Don't you guess, really, that was what people tried to do once, and things got mixed up some way or other, and got about 10 days out of kilter?
Yes, I imagine it was that way.
Well, why don't we just start our new year then with, what you call it, the solstice? It seems simpler.
Yes, but you can't just go fooling with the calendar. That's been established for a long time. You can't just shift it.
Well, didn't someone named Julian do it? And weren't there riots and things? But still, they did change it.
They did change it. Yes, you're right. And I suppose we can change it now if we want to. It certainly gives a person a sense of power.
Then, in playfulness of imagination, they decided that living where they did, they had a system all worked out before them, so that they would not even bother to have months and things like that unless they wanted to, because from the hill, they could see the sun setting around its whole arc. They could merely date things by the time the sun set in the middle of the gate, or the time it had reached the first big hump to the north, or the time it had begun to reach the various points along the long slope of the mountain. What was the use of merely having months?
Say, she said suddenly, it must be pretty nearly Christmas, too. I hadn't thought of that. You think I can get down before the stores close to pick you a tie?
He looked back at her with a little smile. I suppose we ought to feel pretty lugubrious this Christmas, and yet, some way, I can't.
Next year, she said, this ought to be even more fun. We'll have to get him his first tree.
Yes. And he can have a rattle too, can he? What I'm looking forward to, though, is when he can get an electric train, and I can run it. No, poor guy. I guess there'll never be an electric train for him. Maybe, though, when we have grandchildren in 25 years, maybe we'll be able to get the electricity working again.
25 years? I'll be a pretty old woman by that time. It's strange, thinking forwards now, as well as backwards. For a while, I only thought backwards. But that thinking ahead brings up something else to my mind, also. The years. We'll have to keep track of the years. Don't people on desert islands cut notches in trees or something like that? You see, he'll want to know what year it is, so he can vote or get a passport or report to his draft board, maybe. Only perhaps you aren't going to restore things like that for us in this new civilization. What is this year anyway now? Again, he thought that was like a woman, to put even such an all-important thing as the very date in terms of her unborn child. But yet, as so often, her instinct was right. A great pity if the historical record should be broken at some point. Doubtless, in the long run, archaeologists could restore the continuity by means of varves or dendrochronology, but it would save a lot of work if someone merely kept the tradition.
You're right, he said. And it's simple, too, of course. We know what year it is now, and when we decide we've come to New Year's, we'll just chisel a new date on some good rock, and then every year chisel the next one. The chiseling will be quite a job, and so we'll always remember whether we are up to date or not.
Isn't that rather silly, too? She said. I mean, starting out with a date in four figures. As far as I'm concerned. She paused for a moment and looked around with that quiet air which sometimes was so impressive. As far as I'm concerned, this past year might as well be the year one. That evening there was no rain. The clouds still hung low, but the air was clear beneath them. You could have seen the lights of San Francisco, if there had been any lights. He stood on the porch and looked out toward the dark west, breathing the cool damp air in deeply. His mood was still close to exaltation. Now we have finished with the past, he thought. These last few months, the tag end of the year, we shall let the past have them. This is the moment zero, and we stand between two eras. Now the new life begins. Now we commence the year one. The year one. Now there lay before him no longer the mere drama of a world without men and of its constant adaptation. No longer would personal readjustment be his own dominating problem. Now, there stretched away in the years ahead the unfolding drama of a new society, reconstructing itself, moving on. And now, he would not be the lonely spectator, at least not merely that. He could read. He was equipped with the background of much knowledge already. He would extend that into techniques, into psychology, into political science, if that were needed. There must be others that he could find also to join with them, good people who would help in the new world. He would start looking for people again. He would look craftily, trying to keep away from all those who had suffered too much from the shock, whose minds or bodies were not what one wanted to build up the new society. Somewhere within him, there lingered still that one deep fear that she might die in childbirth, that the whole hope of the future might thus fade, and yet he could really not fear it very deeply. Her courage burned too brightly. She was life. He could not associate her with death. She was the light for the future, she and those that would spring from her. Oh, mother of nations, and her children shall call her blessed. He himself would have had only the courage to live on, feeling death creep in closer year by year, as once the darkness had crept in from the corners of the room when the lights were failing. Her stronger spirit had struck back against death, and already life built up anew within her. From her depths, courage flowed out to him. It was curious, doubtless even illogical, that the thought of the coming child should make so much difference, but he granted the difference. He had known despair, but now he knew hope. He looked forward with confidence to the time when the sun would again be setting in the southern end of its long arc, and the two of them, or the three, would go to carve into some rock the numeral commemorating the end of the year one. It was not finished. The thing would go on. A phrase leaped into his mind. O world without end, he thought. As he stood there looking out into the dark west over the empty city, breathing deeply of the cool damp air, the words sang in his mind. O world without end. World without end. Here ends part one. The interchapter called Quick Years follows, after a time interval of 1 year. Quick Years. Not far from the house on San Lupo Drive, there was that area which had once been a small public park. Tall rocks rose picturesquely, and at one place the tops of two of them leaned together, forming a high, narrow cave. Nearby, a smooth rock surface, as large as the floor of a small room, sloped with the hillside, but was not too steep to sit uncomfortably. In those older times, which had been before even those that were now called the old times, some tribe of simple people had lived thereabouts, and on the smooth rock surface you still saw the little holes where those people had pounded with stones to make their acorn mash. One day, after the round of the seasons had passed and the sun for the second time sank well to the south of the Golden Gate, Ish and Em climbed the hillside toward the rocks. The afternoon was calm and sunny, warm for midwinter. Em carried the baby, wrapped in a soft blanket, She was pregnant again, although not yet heavy on her feet. Ish carried his hammer and a cold chisel. Princess started with them, but as always went baying off on the trail of one of her rabbits. When they came to the rock, Em sat down on it in the sun and nursed the baby, and Ish worked with hammer and chisel, cutting into the smooth surface the single numeral. The rock was hard, but with the heavy hammer and the sharp chisel, he soon finished an upright line. But it was fun to adorn the work a little, and some ceremony seemed fitting to mark the end of their first full circuit of the sun from south back to south. So Ish cut a clean serif at the base of the line, and a little hook at the top, so that the finished figure resembled the neat one, which he remembered in the times of printing. When he was done, he sat close beside Em in the sun. The baby had finished feeding and was happy. They played with him. "Well," said Ish, "that was the year one."
"Yes," said Em. "But I think I shall always remember it as the year of the baby. Names are easier to remember than numbers."
Thus, from the very beginning, it came about that they called each year not so often by its number as by a name based on something that had happened during that time. In the spring of the second year, Ish planted his first garden. He had never liked gardening, and that probably explained why, in spite of good resolutions and two half-hearted attempts, he had not grown anything during the first year. Nevertheless, as he turned over the dark, moist soil with the spade, he felt a deep satisfaction at being in touch again with primeval things. That was about all the satisfaction he got from the garden. To begin with, the seed. He had had a hard time to find any at all because of the ravages of the rats, was several years old, and much of it failed to sprout. Snails and slugs soon moved in, but by scattering a box of snail killer, he eliminated them and felt triumphant. Then, just as the lettuce was making a good growth, a buck jumped the fence and wrought havoc. Ish put another layer on the top of the fence. Next, some rabbits burrowed beneath. More destruction and more work. One evening, he heard crashing noises and rushed out just in time to scare off a predatory cow on the point of smashing a way through the fence. More work. By this time, he was waking up at night with thoughts of ravening deer, rabbits, and cattle prowling around his fence and ogling his lettuces with eyes that gleamed like tiger's eyes. Then, in June, the insects arrived. He sprayed poison until he was afraid he would not dare eat the lettuce, even if any lived to be harvested. The crows were the last to find the garden. But when they arrived in July, their numbers made up for their late arrival. He stood guard and shot some of them, but they seemed to post sentries and swoop down as soon as his back was turned, and he could not watch during all the daylight hours. His scarecrows and dangling mirrors kept them off for a day, but after that, they lost their fear. In the end, he actually erected a shelter of fly screen over the few rows of garden, which seemed worth saving. And he harvested a little lettuce, along with some scrawny tomatoes and onions. But he conscientiously let some of the plants go to seed, and saved the fresh seed for the future. He was as thoroughly discouraged as any amateur gardener had ever been. It was one thing apparently to grow vegetables when thousands of others were doing the same, and quite another when yours was the only plot. And so from miles around, every vegetable-hungry animal and bird and mollusk and insect came galloping or flying or oozing or hopping and apparently sending out by signals to its fellows the universal shout, "Let's eat." Toward the end of summer, the second baby was born. They called her Mary, just as they decided finally to call the first one John, so that the old names would not vanish from the earth. When the new baby was only a few weeks old, there was another memorable event. This was the way of it. In those first years, though Ish and Em stayed contentedly close at home,
They now and then had visits from wanderers who had seen the smoke on San Lupo Drive and headed for it, sometimes in cars, more often on foot. These people, with one exception, seemed to be suffering from shock. They were bees who had lost the hive, sheep without a flock. By now, Ish concluded, the ones who had made a good adjustment must already have settled down. Besides, no matter whether the wanderer was a man or a woman, the old problem of three's a crowd reared up. So Ish and Em were glad when one of these restless and unhappy people decided to continue wandering. The exception was Ezra. Ish always remembered how Ezra came strolling along the street that hot September day, his face florid, his half-bald head even redder, his jaw narrow and pinched, his bad teeth showing suddenly when he saw Ish and stopped and smiled. "Hiya, boy," he had said. And though the words were American, still behind them somewhere was the ghost of a North of England accent. He stayed until after the first rains. He was always pleasant, even when his teeth were growling. He had that inexpressibly great gift of making people feel comfortable. The babies always smiled for Ezra. Ish and Em would have urged him to stay permanently, but they feared the triangle situation, even when the outsider was as easygoing and perceptive as Ezra. So one day, when he seemed restless, they sent him off, telling him jokingly to find himself a pretty girl and then come back and join them. They were sad after he had gone. At the time of his leaving, the sun was again far to the south. So when they went to the flat rock and cut the numeral two, Ezra was still in their minds, though he was gone, and they did not expect to see him again. He would have been, they thought, a good helper, a good person to have around. To his memory, they called it the Year of Ezra. The year three was the year of the fires. Just after midsummer, the smoke suddenly drifted over everything, and it stayed, lighter and heavier through 3 months. The babies sometimes woke up coughing and choking, their eyes watering. Ish could realize what was happening. The western forests were no longer primeval woodlands of big trees, through which a fire could sweep and do little damage. On the contrary, because of logging and man-caused fires, the forests consisted mostly of thick and highly inflammable second growth, made all the worse by slash piles and brush fields. Man had produced this kind of forest, and it was dependent upon him, surviving only because of his vigorous efforts at fire suppression. Now the hoses lay neatly coiled, and the bulldozers reddened with rust. And in this summer, a very dry one, over all Northern California, and doubtless in Oregon and Washington too, the lightning-set fires were raging uncombated through the tangled second growth and blazing up in the tinder-dry slash piles. One horrible week they even saw the fires burning brightly in the night, all along the north side of the bay, sweeping the slopes of the mountain from bottom to top, and dying out only when there was nothing left to burn. The broad arms of the bay fortunately kept the fire on the north side, and there were no lightning storms on the south side to start new fires. When it was all over, Ish believed that there must be very few forests left unburned in California, and centuries would be required to grow them again. In this year, also Ish really settled down to reading, another sign that he was finally adjusting to the situation. He got his books from the city library and kept the million volumes of the university as a great reserve to be tapped when the time was ripe. Although he often thought that he should use his reading to make himself skillful in such fields as medicine and agriculture and mechanics, he found that what he actually wanted to read was the story of mankind. He plunged through innumerable volumes of anthropology and history and went on into philosophy, particularly the philosophy of history. He read novels and poems and plays, which also were the story of mankind. Sometimes in the evening, when he was reading and Em was knitting and the babies were asleep upstairs and Princess was lying lazily in front of the fire,
Sometimes then, Ish would look up and think that his father and mother had passed many evenings in just the same way. But then, he would see the gasoline lamp and turn his eyes up to the dead electric light bulbs in the ceiling fixture. The year 4 was the year of the coming. One day in early spring, about noon, Princess leaped up barking wildly and dashed for the street, and then they heard a car horn tooting. Ezra had been gone for more than a year, and they had stopped thinking about him. But there he was, in a jalopy-looking car, overflowing with people and household goods. Ish couldn't help thinking of an Okie outfit arriving in California in the old times. Besides Ezra, there crawled out of the car a woman of about 35, a younger woman, a frightened-looking half-grown girl, and a little boy. Ezra introduced the older woman as Molly, and the younger as Jean. And after each name, he added calmly and without embarrassment, "My wife." Ish suffered only mild shock at the fact of bigamy. He had been through a great many experiences already, and he reacted quickly to realize that plurality of wives had been an accepted part of many great civilizations in the past and might well be again in the future. It was certainly a practical situation when there were two women available and only one man, especially when the man was like Ezra, able to live comfortably with people under all sorts of conditions. The little boy was Ralph, Molly's son. He had been born only a few weeks before the great disaster and had presumably either inherited an immunity or absorbed it through his mother's milk. This was the only case, so far as they knew, of two members of the same family surviving. The half-grown girl they called Evie, but nobody really knew her right name. Ezra had found her living in squalor and solitude, opening cans to find what she needed, grubbing for worms and snails. She must have been 5 or 6 years old at the time of the great disaster. Whether she had always been half-witted, or whether the shock of death and solitude had rendered her so, no one knew. She cowered and whimpered, and even Ezra could win a smile from her only now and then. She knew a few words, and after they had been kind to her for a long time, she gradually came to talk more, but she never grew normal. Later in the same year, Ish and Ezra went off together for a few days in Ish's old station wagon. The trip was not a pleasant one. They had tire trouble and engine trouble, and the roads were rough. Nevertheless, they accomplished what they had set out to do. They located George and Maureen, whom Ezra had found on one of his wanderings. George was a big shambling fellow, gray around the temples, good-natured, uncertain in speech but deft in his trade, which was carpentry. "Too bad," thought Ish. "A mechanic or a farmer would have been better for us." Maureen was his female counterpart, except that she was some 10 years younger, around 40 probably. She loved housekeeping as George loved carpentry. As for their mental processes, you might call George dull, but you would have to call Maureen stupid. Privately, Ish and Ezra discussed George and Maureen and decided that they were good, solid people, comfortable to have around, more a source of strength than of weakness. It was a little, Ish thought wryly, like deciding whether you would give someone a bid to your fraternity, and when there were so few to choose from, you couldn't be too choosy. In the end, George and Maureen came along back in the station wagon. Ish and Maureen found that they had one experience in common. As a little girl in South Dakota, she had been bitten by a rattlesnake. Toward the end of this year, Em bore her second son, whom they named Roger. So by that time, the people living on San Lupo Drive numbered 7 adults and 4 children, and Evie besides. About then, they began, at first as a joke, to talk of themselves as the tribe. The year 5 supplied no very startling occurrence. Both Molly and Jean had babies, and Ezra was as pleased as a 2-time father should be. In the end, they called it the Year of the Bulls. This was because there was a plague of cattle that year.
just as from the first months they all remembered the plagues of the ants and the rats. Cattle had gradually got to be more and more numerous. Very rarely did anyone see a horse, never a sheep. But it was good country for cattle, and they reached a climax in this year and became a nuisance. To be sure, you easily got all the steak you wanted, though it was tough. But you had continual trouble running into a cross bull when you were merely wanting to walk here or there. You could always shoot a bull, but shooting one near the houses either meant that you had to go to all the trouble of burying the carcass or of dragging it away, or else you suffered from the smell. They all had to become adept at stepping quickly out of the way when a bull charged, and they came to make something of a sport of this, and to call it bull dodging. The year 6 was an eventful one. During its course, all four of the women bore children, even Maureen, who had seemed too old. There was, however, now that M had led the way, a strong drive toward the having of many children. Each of the adults had for a time lived alone, had experienced what they now called the great loneliness, and the strange dread that went with it. Even now, their little group was only a tiny candle against the pressure of surrounding darkness. Each newborn baby seemed to give the uncertain flame a stronger hold and to push the darkness of annihilation back a little. At the end of this year, the number of children, which was 10, exceeded the number of adults. And then, of course, there was Evie, who was hardly to be counted in either group. But it was an eventful year for other reasons, too. It was a year of drought and of little grass, and the too numerous cattle grew thin and wandered everywhere searching food. Driven mad by hunger, they crashed the strong fence around the little vegetable plot one night. The aroused men emptied rifles into the milling cattle at short range, but before they could be driven off, the garden was utterly ruined. Ironically, by being trampled out, for in the confusion of the milling herd, no animal had been able to eat. To crown all this came the grasshoppers. They descended suddenly and ate up everything that the cattle could not reach. They ate the leaves from the trees and the flesh from the ripening peaches, so that the bare seeds hung from the ends of the leafless branches. Then the grasshoppers died, and their stench was everywhere. After a while, the cattle also lay dead by hundreds in the dry stream beds and muddy water holes, and their stench too filled the air. By now, the land was stripped bare, as if it would never recover. A horror fell upon the people. Ish tried to explain to them that it was all a part of the jostling for readjustment after the loss of human controls. There was bound to be, for instance, a plague of grasshoppers during the first year when conditions favored them, now that their breeding grounds were not disturbed by cultivation. But with the stench in the air and the whole earth looking dead, he could not be very convincing. George and Maureen took to prayer. Jean made fun of them openly, saying that what had happened in the last few years didn't give her confidence in this God business. Molly went into depressions and wept loudly at times. In spite of his rationalistic explanations, even Ish was despondent for the future. Of the adults, only Ezra and Em showed the capacity for taking things as they came. The older children seemed to be little affected. They gulped their canned milk greedily, even when the stench was thickest. John, they already were calling him Jack, held his father's hand with confidence and looked with mild 6-year-old interest at a cow which had tottered along the street and lay dying in the sun. He obviously accepted it as just part of his world. But the nursing babies, except Em's, absorbed a sense of disaster through their mother's milk. They wailed fretfully, thus disturbing their mothers all the more. They set up a vicious circle. October was a month of horror. Then came the miracle. 2 weeks after the first rain, they looked out, and the hills were a faint green with sprouting grass. Everyone was suddenly happy, and Molly and Maureen wept with pleasure. Even Ish was relieved, for in the last weeks the despair of the others had shaken his confidence in the basic recuperative powers of the earth itself, and he had begun to doubt whether any seed remained. When, at the time of the winter solstice, The people all gathered once more at the smooth expanse of rock to cut the numeral into the surface and to name the year. They were uncertain what they should call it. It might be, for good omen, the year of the four babies. But it might be the year of the dead cattle or the year of the grasshoppers. In the end, the evilness of the year prevailed in their thoughts. So they called it simply the bad year. The year 7 was a strange one also. The mountain lions suddenly seemed to be everywhere. You hardly dared to walk between houses without carrying a rifle and having a dog at heel to give warning, and the dog kept usually very close at heel also. The lions never quite dared attack a man, but they picked up 4 dogs, and you were never quite sure whether one of them might not just suddenly leap from a tree. The children had to be kept indoors. What had happened was again obvious enough to Ish. During the years when there had been so many cattle, the lions must have bred rapidly, and now that the cattle had perished in the drought, the lions were left without food and ravenously were closing in. In the end, there was bad luck, because Ish missed his shot, and instead of killing a lion, merely raked it across the shoulders, and it charged and mauled him before Ezra could get another shot home. After that, he walked with a little limp and became very tired when he had to sit long in the same position as in driving a car. But by now, the roads had gone to pieces badly, and the cars were unreliable, and there were few places to go anyway, so that there was very little car driving. Naturally, they called it the Year of the Lions. The year 8 was comparatively uneventful. They called it the year we went to church. The name amused Ish, for its wording implied that the experiment was over and done with. This had happened in this way. Being merely 7 ordinary Americans, they were of varied religious affiliations or of none at all, and even among the church members, no one had felt any creative religious drive. Ish had gone to Sunday school as a child, but when Maureen asked him what church he belonged to, he had to say that he was a skeptic. Maureen did not know the word, and, jumping to the wrong conclusion, she always referred to Ish thereafter as being a member of the skeptic church. Maureen herself was a Catholic, and so was Molly. They could still cross themselves and say a Hail Mary, but otherwise they were in a bad situation, having no confessor and no way of celebrating Mass. As Ish reflected, the Catholic Church had considered almost all possibilities, but apparently never the one of getting reorganized after the apostolic succession was broken and only 2 women remained. Of the others, George had been a Methodist and a deacon, but he was too inarticulate to turn preacher and not enough of a leader to organize a congregation. Ezra was tolerant of everyone's beliefs, but never let himself be pinned down as to his own, and so probably lacked any convictions. Jean had been a member of some loud-praying modern sect called Christ's Own, but she had seen the congregation pray in vain at the time of the great disaster, and now she had turned definitely anti-religious. Em, who never liked to turn toward the past, was reticent. As far as Ish could tell, she never prayed. Now and then, apparently without thinking of religious implications, she sang hymns or spirituals in her full-throaty contralto. George and Maureen, sinking the Methodist-Catholic differences, were the ones who suggested church services for the sake of the children. They appealed to Ish, who is something of a leader, especially in things intellectual. Maureen broad-mindedly even told him that she would not object to the use of the skeptic form of services. Ish felt the temptation. He could easily piece together some harmless bits of religion, give comfort and confidence to people who might often need it badly, and supply a core of solidity and union to the community. George, Maureen, and Molly would welcome it. Jean should be easy to convert again. Ezra would not stand in the way. But Ish himself hated building upon a foundation of insincerity, and he knew that Em would see through the sham. In the end, they held a service each Sunday. George had kept track of Sunday, or at least thought so. They sang hymns and read from the Bible and stood uncovered for silent prayer, each for himself. But Ish never prayed during the period of silence, and he did not think that Em or Ezra did either. Moreover, Jean maintained her hostility stoutly and never attended. Ish felt that if he had had more fervor or more hypocrisy, he could have argued Jean over. As it was, however, the church services were cultivating disunion rather than unity of feeling, and sham more than true religion. One day, on the spur of the moment, Ish put an end to them. He did it rather neatly, he thought, ending his speech with the idea that they were not really giving up the services, but merely extending the period of silent prayer indefinitely, letting each one of us carry on in his heart as he wishes. Molly wept a little at what seemed to her such a lovely thought, and so the experiment with the church, at least, was ended in harmony. At the beginning of the year 9, there were 7 adults and Evie and 13 children, ranging in age from newborn babies up to Molly's Ralph, who was 9, and Ish and Em's Jack, who was 8. Everybody had a pleasant sense of confidence and security in the growth of the community, or of the tribe, as they now said more often. The birth of each baby was a time of real rejoicing, as the shadows seemed to draw back a little and the circle of light to enlarge. Soon after the beginning of that year, a decent-looking oldish man came up to George's house one morning. He was one of those wanderers who still occasionally, though less and less often, passed through. They received him hospitably, but like the others, he showed little reaction to what they did for him. He stayed only over one night and then went off again, without even saying goodbye, in the aimless way of those shocked ones. He had scarcely gone, it seemed, before people began feeling irritable. All the babies started crying. Then soon there were sore throats and running noses and aching heads and swollen eyes, and the tribe was suddenly in all the throes of an epidemic. This was all the more remarkable because, throughout the preceding years, the general health had been so unbelievably good. Ezra and some of the others had suffered with bad teeth. George, who was the oldest, had complained of various aching joints, which he described under the old-fashioned term rheumatism. Occasionally, a scratch became infected, but even the common cold seemed to have vanished entirely, and there were only 2 diseases that remained active. One of these struck each of the children sooner or later. It was a great deal like measles in its symptoms, and doubtless it was measles, and that was what they called it, lacking any doctor to make them sure. The other began with a violent sore throat, but yielded so quickly to sulfa pills that no one really knew its full course. As long as there were sulfa pills in any drugstore, and they kept potent in spite of age, Ish saw no need to find out experimentally just how this sore throat would develop if left untreated. Why so few diseases remained? This seemed miraculous to people like George and Maureen, and they were inclined to be superstitious about the matter. They felt that God, in some great anger, had nearly wiped out the human race in one vast plague, and thus being satisfied, had seen fit to remove the minor plagues as a kind of compensation. Just as, after Noah's flood, he had set the rainbow in the sky as a sign that there would never again be another such flood. To Ish, however, the explanation was plain. Since so large a proportion of the people had died, the chain of most infections had been broken, and many individual diseases had, you might say, died when their particular kinds of bacteria became extinct. Of course, there would still be the diseases which might spring from the mere deterioration of the human body, such as heart failure and cancer and George's rheumatism, and there might also be animal-borne infections like tularemia and tick fever. Also, there could be, here and there, individual survivors who carried some disease in chronic form, but could still pass it on to others, just as someone of themselves had probably been responsible for the survival of measles.
The old man